Across America and around the world, once again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time. For those who have ears, let them hear. For those who have eyes, let them see. And for those who have a brain, let them think. There are, in our midst, those who seek the destruction of America as a sovereign nation, who are trying in every possible way to destroy the spirit of this great nation. But, ladies and gentlemen, there are also many who are still American in spirit. There are many who waver on the brink of their own enslavement because of the hypnosis employed, and these men and women are gravely concerned. During every speech and every workshop that I make, as I travel around this great nation, I'm asked questions. one of which is, it is constantly stated by those who are trying their best to keep nationalism active in the hearts of Americans that the patriot loves his country and endeavors to serve it, that such love of country should be universally esteemed a virtue. Is this true? It cannot be contradicted, dear listeners, that the Englishman is intensely partial to his country. He's a nationalist from the toes of his feet to the top of his head. And this is true of every citizen of nearly every civilized country in the world. And of course, it is accepted by all the world as natural, normal, and to be encouraged. It is only in America that many who think themselves American permit hordes from foreign countries to make every effort to root out this Americanism and to destroy nationalism, even those who have, through their heritage and their history, become as American as every other, see themselves as something else, Irish American, East European Jews, African American, and I tell you there is no such thing. You are American or you are not. If nationalism or love of country is desirable in countries which America helps to support, certainly it must be good for loyal Americans. And I go one step further. You see, I do not believe in my country right or wrong. I believe in the ideal of America. I believe in the principles and ideals upon which it is based, the foundation upon which it sits, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution of the United States of America, and the first 10 amendments to that document known collectively as the Bill of Rights. In seeking the welfare of his country, is it not possible that one may mistake the means thereto and plunge his country into irreparable harm? Absolutely. But such a thing is impossible if one is imbued with the spirit, ladies and gentlemen, of Americanism. His first thought, in accordance with the divine law is his own individualization. Something you don't hear much anymore. His own individualization, the effort to bring into manifestation the constructive energy within himself. In this thought, desire, and effort is also included the welfare of his country and his fellow citizens. You see, the limit of one's obligations to society is to support actions which protect life and liberty equally for all. For all. Accordingly, the true American does not commit crimes against others, interfere with others' freedom of action, take even indirectly as government support or subsidy anything he has not by his own efforts honestly earned. Even more important these days, he does not condone or engage in action to compel others to a given course of action thought to be socially desirable. Restraint, ladies and gentlemen, of evil or destructive forces is within the divine law. Compulsion of any kind is against this law. Man must have a free will choice. Under this law, no one, although he may have the power and authority to bring about enmity between his and other countries or interfere with them, may wage war except in self-defense. This was the basis of the Constitution of the United States of America. It expressly forbids standing armies except in time of invasion or insurrection. And it limits the funding of those armies to a period of only 2 years. The only constitutionally standing force is the United States Navy. And it stands simply to protect the vessels of trade. belonging to the citizens of this great nation. You didn't know that, and I know you didn't know that. If you have a copy of the Constitution, if you read it, it will become plain to you. It is as plain as the nose upon your face if you would just read it. Under the law, no one, although he may have the power and authority to bring about enmity between his and other countries or interfere with them, may wage war except in self-defense. However, the question in general concerns only those who are on the path toward the attainment of true freedom. Wisdom, the ultimate of the soul's achievement, the individualization of the whole person. Those who are preparing for the work for freedom and not the enslavement planned for them by the Ark Destroyer and his ambassadors, now so active. It must be accepted as a maxim that man cannot be entirely free until he succeeds in individualizing himself and is able to stand alone, meeting all conditions and all forces as they confront him. In modern times, Admiral Byrd might be cited as one example, living as he did, alone for many months, thousands of miles away from all of his fellow men. However, no one should be bold enough to form an opinion on what took place in his mind and soul during those months while alone and suffering from a grave illness. He was forced to depend solely upon his own resources. How many of you are able to so function? Another example of individualization in the attainment of freedom was that of Bunyan, who, given the choice of recanting his opinions and his teachings or being incarcerated in an indescribable dungeon, chose the dungeon. He might, like millions of others, have chosen physical freedom by denying the soul's spiritual destiny. This would have made him both a craven coward and a victim to a constantly accusing conscience, much like what happens to me when I try to shirk my duty as a messenger to the world. But he took advantage of his isolation to create the immortal masterpiece called Pilgrim's Progress. It was a volume that earned him undying fame and ultimate physical freedom. Those who imprisoned him did not succeed in enslaving him, nor in destroying his individuality, and are long since passed into the silence and forgottenness of all evil ones who then as now, being in temporal power, foolishly think they can accomplish what no others could. Like those of the past, they also will soon be forgotten or mentioned only with derision and hatred. Many Americans believe Patrick Henry, the first to voice the inner feelings of man, that it is far better to die in an effort to be free than live and be a slave to tyrants. But the idea, dear listeners, is as old as organized society and was well developed 2,000 years ago. There were those who lived during the life of Jesus Christ, called the Nazarene, and labored for the welfare of mankind, who clearly foresaw the shadow of tyranny that was to follow in coming ages and forewarned future generations. Unfortunately for mankind, throughout the ages, and more so today in the present, few have ever heeded the warning until it was too late. And then they proved too weak to free themselves from the shackles which they had permitted, yes, permitted to be forged, enslaving themselves. Apollonius, who is believed to have been active during the lifetime of Jesus and taught the law of individual freedom and spiritualization, traveled over much of the then-known world, preaching, healing, and teaching that, quote, wise men must be ready to lay down their lives for their beliefs, freedom is a faith based on a spiritual concept to which all men, both sages and laymen, must cleave, unquote. Many of you have called this broadcast a ministry, and I have clarified that for you by telling you this is a ministry of freedom. At about the same time that Apollonius gave voice to this law of individualization and freedom, another, no less than Jesus, gave utterance to the law and its direct effect on those who would listen. And there's been no change in this law or in its operation. He said, and I quote, "But whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty and continueth therein, he being not a forgetting bearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed," unquote. James chapter 1, verse 25. Today, these are comparatively few in number, as was foreseen and indicated by the statement, quote, "Many are called, but few are chosen," unquote. Matthew chapter 20, verse 16. This has reference to those who are trying to follow the precepts of Jesus Christ, the Nazarene. Apollonius and the sages, wise men of all times, of all ages, in their efforts to become the selected, the spiritually conscious, but fail to realize that there can be no freedom unless they so obey as to individualize themselves. You see, peace between men cannot be established by legislation or force as long as there is enmity between brother and brother. We must make effort to establish peace between ourselves, bearing in mind the question, quote, "What is that to thee?" unquote. What other men do, "Follow thou the law, and all will be well with thee." Were Jesus, Apollonius, Patrick, Henry, and Nathan Hale among us today, they would be both amazed and extremely saddened that the people of this land of destiny, this promised land of freedom and peace, with the exception of a very few of loyal heart, and I know most all of them, were making little or no effort to maintain even the liberty that is still left. They gradually are being destroyed, as certainly as in the preceding dark ages, believing in their short-sightedness and ignorance that such a thing cannot happen here or to them. We doubt if our founding fathers would be at all surprised that in this hour of man's inertia and inattention, and the hour approaching the crisis, that the old devil had let loose his most prized co-workers to work without ceasing toward the debasement of the citizens of a once great people, to enslave them, and that these agents make no secret whatsoever of their mission. Stop calling it a conspiracy. I have proven over and over again that all is in the open. All is available to anyone who wishes to look. You see, dear listeners, the war of Armageddon is now actually in progress, but has not yet reached its greatest activity. It's not a war in the usual sense. And if you read chapter 1 of my book, Behold a Pale Horse, you understand that it is a silent weapon war. It is, in fact, a quiet war for silent weapons. At its height, there will be elimination by unusual weapons, to be sure. The results is pointed out by one of these agents, and I quote, "There are many reasons for expecting a long period of authoritarian control or enslavement by the strongest of the survivors. the people who were best prepared in advance who chose the time and method of attack, unquote. Apollonius and Jesus appealed to all who would listen, but few heeded their warning, and mankind paid a terrible penalty from which all now should learn a lesson, although from appearances very few will, even those listening to this broadcast will not move their butts from their couch to take action, except but a few, who are known to me for the most part. Patrick Henry appealed to a few. These few listened to him and acted accordingly, and the greatest freedom and opportunity ever known upon this earth became the lot of men. Now, because of inertia, apathy, ignorance, stupidity, lack of courage, or an innate weakness, another such cloud of darkness is hanging over America and its once free people, and at this very moment is becoming denser and darker day by day. There are those who are becoming conscious of this danger and are sounding a warning, being well aware that if this process of degeneration on the one hand and control on the other is permitted to fully develop, there is little hope of America becoming the last hope of man's freedom until after the ending of Armageddon, and then only with the beginning of reconstruction by those who have become the, quote, selected, unquote, as a result of their freedom through the process of individualization. God gave to those who would inhabit the land known as America and to those who are Americans in fact and spirit a great promise. But it was based upon a proviso that this America shall be the home of the truly free, but to obtain that freedom and the benefits of the promise, men must prove their worth. Men must prove their worth. The eternal quest for freedom is not a political affair. It is basically spiritual because it primarily concerns the well-being of the immortal soul, the spiritual being indwelling within man, but unable to attain its highest estate while the mind is entangled in darkness and confusion and the body enslaved. You who are on freedom's path toward the ultimate goal of attainment, awaken quickly and fully to the dangers immediately confronting you. And while you are seeking the enlightenment of the soul and the attainment of individualization, be certain that you do not permit your mind and body to become enslaved. Forget not for one single moment that salvation of the soul must proceed hand in hand with the freedom of mind and body, as so clearly pointed out by Jesus Christ, the Nazarene. When he said this, ladies and gentlemen, and pay very close attention, quote, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, that which is material, and unto God that which belongs to God, or the spiritual." St. Matthew chapter 22. Verse 21. I challenge you to stir in your conscience and in your soul, if you have one, and bring forth the courage that is needed to make you free. Most of you are held in the bonds, the chains of fear. And fear is a destroyer. It can also be a savior. It is both the actuator of evil and the protector against evil. Most of you don't realize that. Like all things in nature, it is a dual force. And like the two-edged sword of fable, cuts or is active in both directions. Fear is generally considered evil, an inhibiting force. And this is because fear, as a human weakness, prevents man from making the efforts he might otherwise make to become a giant among men. A giant. You see, all great things ever performed by man have been performed by individuals. Whenever a group made great change, they were always motivated and compelled and led by one individual. Fear, ladies and gentlemen, on the other hand, because of the anticipation of consequences, keeps millions from crimes of every type because they believe God or the courts will punish them for evils that they commit. They're unaware that it is not God who punishes, but their own acts and reaction. While it is true that fear prevents their doing evil, it is equally true that they are none the better, but are merely negative in goodness. Do you understand what that means? Few of these are aware that their desires are as potent under divine law to punish them as would be the act itself. There is but one difference, but this is important. Others are not affected by the intent as they would have been had the evil deed been done. And as stated most eloquently by St. Matthew in his positive exposition of the law, and I quote, "He who lusts after woman in his heart already has committed the act," unquote, St. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. This law, ladies and gentlemen, governs all of man's thoughts and desires, the kind wish, even if it is impossible to fulfill it, will return benefit to the thinker. But why should man have such strong fear? What was its beginning? Is it not this sense or feeling of fear which has almost since the beginning of time been played upon as the harpist does on his harp by those aware of man's weakness? And has it not enslaved all but a few throughout the ages? Is this not the secret weapon used today, which first impressed and then converted or hypnotized the masses to present-day godlessness, destroying the soul, ideologies of evil? The beginning of fear is easily traced to the time when man's physical and mental development reached a degree enabling him to think. He looked about himself and all he saw and became aware of the danger to himself and to those he loved and for whom he felt responsible. Danger confronted man wherever he looked. And he was immediately conscious that if he desired to live, if he wanted to protect those associated with him, he would need to find a means of defense. Henceforth, the greater portion of his thoughts was based on fear and foreboding of what might be and a means of protection against it. You see, this fear sense became an integral part of him, and when one source of danger was removed or overcome, there immediately was another. For man's mind is fertile. As the sources of danger changed, so must the means of defense. Throughout the early ages of man, his consciousness was different from that of other sentient creatures. His defense was based on some form of battle. Then in later ages came formal war to threaten life, and still later appeasement based upon craftiness. And this has continued to the present. And man can only lessen his fears by learning the truth. Seek ye the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And I tell you, nothing else will. The truth, the governing law,
and realistic means of self-defense only comes by knowing the truth. You see, man's only safety lies in not permitting himself to be influenced either by others' promises of benefits or by his own selfish interests, which would infringe upon the rights and possessions of his fellow man. Fear can only be eliminated by refusing to be selfish or trying to obtain possessions of any kind except by faithful service and effort, by production and refusal to accept any subsidies not based on exchange of equal value. To do otherwise is to become enslaved. One immediately arouses the ever-present innate fear of reprisals or being made to pay later, and possibly unable to do so. In most instances, man has not been enslaved, ladies and gentlemen. He has enslaved himself by greed or selfishness for physical, mental, material, and even spiritual benefits on easy terms, without paying for that which he desired, either by effort or exchange. The classic example in all betrayals of manhood and freedom is that of Satan, in effect the devil, attempting to entice Jesus, the Nazarene, on the mount. Jesus was wise in his knowledge that it is impossible to obtain something for nothing without payment, thus becoming enslaved. You all misunderstood what you read. I'm telling it to you straight now. Jesus was wise in his knowledge that it was impossible to obtain something for nothing without payment, thus becoming enslaved. Throughout time, man has refused to learn this simple lesson. He remains by nature a gambler and foolishly believes that he can do that which no other man has been able to do. Win against the ever-operating law of exchange or justice. The acceptance, ladies and gentlemen, of these ideologies has robbed man of his self-defense by causing him to actually believe that since there is nothing which he formerly believed in, there can be no reaction to his misdeeds, no punishment. Since there is no one who can punish, therefore he is free to do as he pleases without fear of anything, there being nothing to fear. This mental impression becomes so strong that the sense of right is entirely lost. Conscience dead due to the fact that he has become spiritually decadent. Has the fear born in man as a result of his environment and ignorance failed to serve any good purpose? Perhaps, almost with the birth of consciousness there, and the sense of fear, there was also born the thought, quote, there must be a way, unquote. We cannot know with certainty, except by what men experience today in dire emergencies, but faith was born. And with faith were born those who live by the waters of faith. This was the thought, not fully understood, that since there is such a problem to be met, there must be a way to its solution. Those who work around me quickly learn that excuses incur my wrath. The word I can't incurs my wrath. For my whole life has lived in the waters of faith, and in my family there's only one rule, one law. Trust in God and just do it. No excuses. No I can'ts. No bullshit. Just trust in God and just do it. This thought or faith gave birth to courage, and the determination to win. And then and there, another element of manhood was born, that of will, our determination. Those of you who believe that everything on this earth was preordained are fools playing a fool's game. For if it is true, then life and religion and God and man are just the butt of a great joke, and someone is laughing loudly somewhere. That kind of thinking is born out of irresponsibility, so that you can blame all upon God or upon the devil or upon someone, but nothing falls upon your shoulders, for it has all been preordained. And I tell you, you are sick in that philosophy. Faith gives birth to courage and the determination to win. And another element of manhood is born with that determination and that of will. In the beginning, so we believe, there was no temper to mislead men by false and destructive promises of an easier way. For man was on his own. He was forced to find ways and means, and in his efforts, a manhood akin to something divine was born. For man discovered he had a soul. Another and most important element gradually entered man's consciousness. And this was that if he, puny as he was, and encircled by constant dangers, could, by faith in himself and effort, overcome insurmountable conditions, then there must be something far greater than himself. The first concept of one greater than himself, one with supreme power and no weaknesses or evil, who must exist, led to the belief that this being could, by faith and effort, be found. And this belief in something greater men call religion, based upon faith. It is through the concept of spirituality and what man may attain by faith, desire, effort, and above all, refusal to listen to the ever-present tempter, that man may gain the ultimate. This concept in the passing of time became the inculcations and training in the temples of arcane initiation. The way of life follows the spiritual path to the knowledge of God. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, very few are willing to follow because it requires the elimination of selfishness, the basis of all evil. Selfishness. Remember, I asked you a question. I threw out a question one night. Could it be that the fall of man is somehow connected with the casting out of Lucifer, of Satan? That which has not been earned does not belong to one whose soul obtains it, and consequently the fear that it will be taken from him. You see, it destroys both peace of conscience and the possibility of remaining a free being. You might ask, is it not generally accepted that self-preservation is the first law of life? If such a law exists, as man's experiences must lead one to believe, does this not support the idea that man is no more than a warring creature, constantly engaged in self-defense, hence some form of destruction, which can hardly be considered spiritual? This is the basic law of life. And dear listeners, it is spiritual in its nature. If man failed to do everything in his power to protect his life, as a result of such neglect lost his life, then the destiny for which the soul came to earth would end there. Without life, a body or medium to function through, spiritual attainment would be impossible, ladies and gentlemen. Spirituality would then be forfeited. You see, if man's life was threatened without cause on his part, and he failed to do everything in his power to prevent death, he would then be guilty of three actual crimes. He would first of all permit the enemy to commit murder. Next, he would be committing suicide by failing to protect the most precious possession given to man by his Creator. And worst of all, he would end whatever his destiny might be, the purpose for which body, mind, and life had been given to him. And I believe it's to learn something. In one respect, man is forced to be a warring, not a murdering creature. And I might inject here that the Ten Commandments does not say in its original form, "Thou shalt not kill." It says, ladies and gentlemen, and you can check this, if you wish, go to the original Hebrew and Greek. It says, "Thou shalt not murder." So in one respect, man is forced to be a warring, not a murdering creature. From his birth, the law of self-preservation forces him to be on guard against every inimical force attempting to destroy him by one means or another. He must be on the alert to prevent man, natural forces, or his own carnal desires to betray him into acts of degradation. Man is a warring creature, but his war, I tell you, his war is an honorable one. It is one of protection. First himself, so that he may protect those he is responsible for, but in doing so must not take unfair advantage of others, nor be guilty of unrighteousness. The nature of this was and is actually spiritual. It is the battle of righteousness against evil. It is a war biblically spoken of as taking place in heaven because it is waged within man's spiritual nature. He fights to fulfill destiny and to finally create heaven on earth for himself and others who follow. By the war of righteousness, wherein there is no selfishness, he attains the consciousness which makes him a man, knowing both good and evil, having chosen good to attain the promised sonship. Notice, you must choose. You must choose. Each and every one of you listening to this broadcast tonight must choose, and you must choose very quickly. You might ask, is there actually a need for some form of evil in the life of man? Was this, together with some form of fear, ordained in the beginning? And I say nothing has been ordained, but if the divine law is to be fulfilled in the life of man, then it is certainly necessary that he, according to sacred concepts, become a crusader in God's cause and not exist as a negative, effortless, uncreative, unproductive creature. A leech, a parasite upon the rest. The first command is that he must become a man in the true sense of the term, and this implies that he must prepare himself to meet the enemy that is ever alert to destroy the best that he has created. He must meet evil as the soldier meets the enemy. Doing this in the righteousness of his conscience neutralizes fear. Many of you call and ask me, Bill, aren't you afraid? My answer has always been and always will be no. No. No, and no. For I know from where I have come, and I know where I am going. I know who I am, and I know that I possess a soul. I fear the actions of no man. I fear the judgment of no man. I fear only the judgment of my God. And I know that if I am doing what is right, I need not ever fear that judgment. And therefore, I am not afraid. Meeting evil, irrespective of the guise in which it appears, builds strength, character, manhood. It likewise allies you with the spiritual forces of God. Strength can only be gained by conflict and victory. Those of you who shrink from conflict, shrink from victory, shrink from manhood, and shrink from God. In this effort, man learns that fear is no more than a weakening sense within the consciousness. As taught in the beginning of any novitiateship, no matter what path you begin in your life, in righteousness there is the power of strength, not weakness, and you'd better make sure that you are in righteousness and not in bigotry. Fear is a weakness to the fearless, the conscience-free. Fear is a delusion. The cause removed, it ceases to exist. The Apostle John put it nicely when he said, quote, perfect love casteth out fear, unquote. 1 John chapter 4, verse 18. If there were no evil, which masquerades, dear listeners, in many forms, there would be nothing for man to overcome and thereby gain strength and wisdom. He would be a weakling, depending upon nature or some force to protect and sustain him, and there is no glory in that. There would be nothing to conquer, no lower to transmute into the higher, nothing to attain. Man, said to be God's noblest creation, would be no more than the least of creatures, the worm beneath the earth. Until man gains wisdom, fear in some form is essential to his existence on this earth, but for the sense of fear, fear is a protector, man would fail to take precautionary measures against the many forces in the world. Forces that we call evils, because in one manner or another, they are of a destructive, misleading, debasing nature. There is the universal enemy we know as disease, affliction, to which almost all men are subject. unless it is recognized and properly or naturally met. It destroys man, even in his youth, ends his usefulness, and prevents his attainment. There is need to be aware. Fear those who would mislead man and take advantage of him to his detriment or possible destruction, which is happening all around us today. Fear, even if based in ignorance or ignobility of nature, induces him to exercise caution, be on the defensive, and will at least partly prevent his committing evils which would reflect back upon himself and prove his undoing. That is the gnawing in your gut that you tell me about as I travel around this country. Bill, something is wrong. I feel it in my gut. Should you fear God? Should you fear God? No. You should fear God's judgment, but only that fear will come if you know that you deserve to be judged harshly. Fearing God is a debasing, degrading misconception of all sacred concepts. There is nothing to fear in God. Man should fear to commit any act that is evil in nature, that may react upon himself or bring evil results upon others. He should fear to commit evil, not because he fears God, but because of the certainty that every evil deed is under the divine law. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. The act will react in harmony with the act itself. In simple words, it may be said that man should fear to commit evil against himself. Don't fear God. Let your love or devotion to God be such as not to do that which is dishonorable. Most people today don't even know what honorable means, much less what dishonorable means. This term includes everything that is ignoble, degrades yourself before the face of God, and destroys the ease of conscience. There's a sacred precept, dear listeners. There is a sacred precept dealing with the thought of fear. All men, especially those on the path, and most appropriately at this time, should bear in mind this scriptural warning. Quote, "Fear not, but that which destroys both body and soul," unquote. The forces inciting to that which we know as evil are ever present and everywhere. Evil, the old devil and his agents, hell's emissaries, are more numerous than ever before in the history of man, and their wiles are beyond the ken of man. On the other hand, the forces of that which we know as good are God's agents, are likewise ever ready to help those in need and seeking protection. It depends upon man's inclinations which will prevail. It depends upon your free will choice which you must make. Evil cannot enter when good is installed. Evil cannot enter the Augean stable that has been cleansed and has become a temple wherein God, all good, dwells. If you know Jesus Christ, if you know God, if you understand what I have just communicated on this broadcast, get in touch with your soul. Get in touch with God. Have no fear, for we stand upon the edge of a precipice. And it will depend upon those of us who understand what is happening to pull us back from the edge of that precipice and restore the greatest efforts of all mankind. Good night, and God bless you all.
heaven.